CITR 101.9, broadcasting from UBC's Point Grey campus, located on the traditional, unceded, Coast Salish territory of the Hunkaminam-speaking Musqueam people. Nisiam, Nisiaya, Thikum Queen Ansep, Hydra Siam, Nisiam, Nisiaya, and the Skakuya, Talitin, Homasqueam, Mustail.
You're listening live to the third official episode of the Armand and Akel Show, bringing you interviews with local activists, politicians, and policy experts from Vancouver and the Lower Mainland. I'm Armand Rana.
And I'm Akil Krishnan. It's Saturday, the 22nd of April at 5.05 p.m. We are broadcasting live from UBC's Vancouver campus on the ancestral, traditional, and unceded territories of the Hunkaminam-speaking Musqueam people.
Akil, I think, how have you been? I think you do a better job of selling things. So why don't you introduce our guest?
Gladly. Our guest today is Daniel Francis, historian and celebrated author of the book Becoming Vancouver, A History. Though it's basically the history of Vancouver at this point. Aside from writing books, he's also been a journalist, having worked in Medicine Hat and Ottawa, contributing to the literary magazine Gist and others. In 2017, he won the Governor General's History Award for Popular Media, the City of Vancouver's Mayor Arts Award for Literary Arts in 2014, and received an Award of Merit from the Vancouver Historical Society for his contributions to the history of the city and the province in 2010. I also believe he once worked at a bookstore.
Yes, I did. There used to be a bookstore, the Book Barrel, down on Granville Street, right about Robson or Dunsmuir. I'm going back to the 1960s now, late 1960s, and I worked there for 9 months.
All right. Yeah, we saw it in your blog. Yeah, thanks so much for coming to speak with us. Daniel, I really appreciate it. It's been a long time coming.
Oh, I look forward to it.
Yeah. So before we dive into the book, I wanted to, spend a bit of time just understanding your own past beyond the bookstore, but including the bookstore. Firstly, how did you end up becoming a historian in your youth? How did that possibility enter your imagination as a possible avenue?
That's a good question. And I often explain that I consider myself more a writer than a historian, and history happens to be what I write about. So as a young person, like many young people with a literary bent, I aspired to be a writer. And it was more or less a case of finding out what my subject was going to be, having discovered that I had no talent at all for fiction or poetry or anything literary. So it was, I went into journalism, and then in Ottawa, where I was working on the newspaper there, I decided to go back to university, do a master's in Canadian studies to become a better journalist. And it was there that I took my first history courses. When I was at UBC in the 60s, I never took any history courses, had no interest in it whatsoever. So it was the early 70s.
That's wild.
At Carleton when I took my first history courses, and I could see right away that this was a subject that I wanted to write about. I didn't have to make anything up. Everything was there. The challenge was to present it in a coherent, appealing, sensible, intelligent way.
So, touching on that, in your blog, you write, quote, "I discovered what interests me most about the study of history. Why do we believe what we believe about the past? And I began to write more about stereotypes and national myths," unquote. You wrote several books, including National Dreams, Myth, Memory, and Canadian History, on this topic. What interested you about this dynamic? And could you just explain this dynamic a bit more?
Yeah. I think I got into it. I'd been a fur trade historian originally when I started out writing about the history of the Canadian fur trade in the West. And that involved, obviously, a lot of Indigenous history. I'm thinking now of the 1990s when the questions of appropriation and so on, appropriation of voice, who could tell what stories, was quite strong. You think it's invented recently, but in fact, it's been around for a long time, that issue. And so I felt a little less comfortable writing in Indigenous history. And I don't exactly know how I came up with the idea. Maybe somebody suggested it to me. But the idea of images, the idea of writing about what white people thought Indigenous people were, rather than writing about Indigenous people themselves. And this is where my book Imaginary Indian came from. The idea being that the Indian sort of exists as this stereotype, image, myth, dream in the minds of non-native people. And so I investigated historically by reading novels and reading history books, school textbooks, and that idea, what these images were, and suggested some ideas about what they meant for Canadian culture at large. And then I carried on with that idea of stereotypes and so on with the next book, National Dreams, where I tried to do the same thing to mainstream Canadian culture. What were some of the big stories Canadians tell themselves? The RCMP, the building of the CPR, that kind of thing. And why did these ideas, these stories, have such a hold on our imagination? And where did they originate?
So could you give us one example that's, you know, quite alive today, and just kind of expand on that? Like, why do we believe in that particular story, like myth? Like, is there one myth that you can really think of that's alive today?
Well, the RCMP is an old perennial. Yeah. As a friend used to say, we're the only country with a police force for a symbol. So I asked myself, why? How did it come about that the RCMP became a symbol of Canada? I go through the history of the force.
So what do you mean, to clarify, what do you mean by we have a police force as a symbol? Like, the symbol of Canada?
They're on stamps, they're on coins. There's hardly a public event that takes place that there isn't a red-coated RCMP officer standing there.
Like, they play a ceremonial role. And
They do. When you look at it, it's particularly odd because when you look at the history of the force, the modern force was actually created to spy on Canadians, to spy on the radical workers' movement that emerged in Canada after World War I. The modern force was created something like 1919, as distinct from the Royal Northwest Mounted Police, who were created in the 1870s to go west and pacify the Indigenous people on the plains. So the modern force was created as a sort of Secret Service spy agency. A part of their history they almost never mention, and certainly they don't glorify in their own official histories. So the point is, what I was doing was investigating the myths, the story we tell ourselves, how something like the police force was treated in novels so positively. There's a whole world of fiction about the RCMP. In movies, many, many movies, especially years ago, were made about the RCMP. They always get their man, all this kind of stuff. And how that image, very positive image, contrasts with the actual history of the force, which is somewhat less flattering.
Yeah, fascinating. Akil, do you want to take the next one?
Yeah, absolutely. So what is it about local politics? I know you've written a lot about other topics. You've written well over 14 books. What is it about local politics? You know, you seem to take a deep interest in local affairs. What is it that really interests you about local affairs?
That's a good question. Not local politics so much as local history, but political history is certainly part of it. And I think it's just I was born here on the West Side, left for several years, but came back and have lived here now for 30 years or so. And it's my community. So it more and more seems to have become the focus of much of what I write about. Before coming back to Vancouver, I lived in Ottawa and wrote about sort of national subjects, as we've just been talking about. But I guess the longer I lived here, again, the more my focus sharpened and became about Vancouver itself. In the year 2000, I guess, I had edited a very large Encyclopedia of British Columbia, which had many contributors, but I was the general editor and I wrote about three quarters of it. And it was a huge project. It took 10 years. So I was looking for something small, local to focus on. And I found the history of Vancouver, specifically in that case, the story of Mayor Louis Taylor, that was the size of project I wanted at the time.
And you've written a book about Mayor Louis Taylor specifically.
That's right, I did. It appeared in 2004. No one will know who he is. I didn't know who he was, which is what made the project interesting to me. I'd grown up in Vancouver, and this was the city's longest-serving mayor. He was mayor from 1909 to 1935, on and off, a total of 11 years, I think, during that period. Highly controversial figure, and yet I had never heard of him. So really, that was the impetus for the, how could that be, I wondered. How had he been erased from the history, which he had basically been erased from the history. So in a way, it was the same kind of approach as I've just been talking about myths and symbols and stuff. I was investigating a reputation or a lack of a reputation and why the present had a certain idea of Louis Taylor and how it differed from what actually took place.
And the seeming absence of a kind of memory of him, even though he had a significant influence on the city.
Yes, exactly.
On a personal level, what would you say? You know, you talk about the history of Vancouver, and you were born and raised Vancouverite. What would you say has been the biggest differences you see, and as the personal experience of Vancouver, of somebody who lived here over the years?
Everybody talks about how much change Vancouver's gone through, and of course it has. That's one experience, is just constant change. The old buildings coming down, the new buildings coming up. But I tend to be drawn, I guess, to the parts of the city that haven't changed much. So I also see quite a bit of constancy in the city, which is comforting to an old guy like me. That everything is not constant change here, but certainly the change is the main thing one thinks about when the change and the location.
Of course,
Vancouver is a place that's famous for its location.
Of course, what are some things that you take comfort in that haven't changed, that are, you know, the history of the city being preserved?
Well, we were talking about Louis Taylor a minute ago and his famous building. He was also a newspaper man. He owned the Vancouver World newspaper from, 1905 to 1915. And he built a building that many Vancouverites will know. I think of it as the World Tower. I think officially it's called the Sun Tower at Pender and just around the corner from Victory Square. I think it's 18 stories tall. So he built that building for his newspaper. And when he was finished, it was the tallest building in the British Empire. But it was eclipsed a couple of years later. Some bank built a new headquarters in Toronto and eclipsed it. But for a while, and it eclipsed the that beautiful orange building on Hastings across the street from Victory Square, the Dominion Building.
The Dominion Building.
And when it was built in 1909, I think, it was the tallest building in the British Empire.
Well, there's a bit of architectural history you don't usually hear.
Yeah. So pre-World War I, Vancouver was booming. And the crash came in 1913, just before the war. But it was booming. And so the equivalent of skyscrapers were being built for the first time in the city. It was a very exciting time. And that's when Taylor got his start. So anyway, what buildings comfort me? I love to see the Sun Tower, Taylor's building, that it's still there after all these years.
It's quite a bit of history.
And the Dominion Building. For that matter. Oh, there's some lovely old buildings in Vancouver.
I guess the two sides of Vancouver, it's kind of like it's like the two towers of Lord of the Rings. You have the journalist's tower and then the bank, I guess, is they're in tension with each other to some degree.
Yeah. Yeah, there is great contrast in the city. And it kind of, the turning point is following World War II in terms of buildings. The BC Electric building, which in my day was a fantastic thing to see. Lights were on all night and right on Burrard at the rise in Burrard. Now converted, still there, of course, but now converted to condos. But it was the headquarters of the BC Electric Company, then BC Hydro, when it opened in the early 60s. And it was kind of the first big modernist building. And by that, I mean steel and glass, as opposed to, think of the Vancouver Hotel, granite, limestone, that kind of thing.
Right.
That contrast between those two materials is kind of contrast between the old-fashioned Vancouver and the new modernist Vancouver that started emerging in the 60s.
And this is the Electro building that's at Burrard and Nelson.
I guess that's what it's called now, yeah.
Great. You also, so we're talking about L.D. Taylor, who was a journalist. You also had some of a career as a journalist yourself. How would you contrast your role as, you know, a writer in terms of history and the journalism that you did?
I was a journalist for a very brief period, one year in Medicine Hat and 2 years in Ottawa at the Ottawa Journal, a newspaper that's now extinct.
That's like longer than my entire career.
Well, and then I left the journal to go back to university, I think, as I said. So, you know, you're not responding to current events, I guess would be certainly one obvious difference, and which is what appealed to me about history and didn't appeal to me about journalism, the constant churn of news. I'm a newspaper addict, so I'm not criticizing anything. I read three newspapers a day, and I still read them as paper newspapers, not online. But I discovered quite quickly it was not, I was not suited to the profession. And history gave me a subject to write about with a longer perspective and more opportunity maybe to fool around with ways of presenting it, which is what really appealed to me, rather than in the strict format of a newspaper.
Yeah, that's cool. For our listeners, thanks so much for tuning in. You're listening to the Armand and Akil Show on CITR 101.9 FM. Do stay tuned. We're going to take a quick ad break. But after that, we're going to actually break down the book Becoming Vancouver and, learn a bit more about history of our wonderful city. So do stay tuned if I can.
The NCRA is excited to bring back the podcast school from March 7th to April 13th, twice a week for 6 weeks. We will be hosting online classes that will be recorded and shared with participants. Classes will cover various podcast-related topics such as the basics, what defines a podcast, and how to be a representative. Visit podcast.ncra.ca to register and learn more about the courses and their presenters.
CITR 101.9 FM Vancouver.
Radio. Happy. Boing.
In the context of Vancouver's opioid crisis, CITR would like to take a moment to share some harm reduction strategies.
Try not to do drugs alone. When going out, let friends know what drugs you're taking and make sure someone has an naloxone kit. If you're able to, get your drugs tested before taking them.
Avoid mixing opioids with alcohol or stimulants. Remember that opioids can include painkillers prescribed by a doctor, and it's possible for any drugs to be contaminated with opioids.
Learn the signs of opioid overdose, which include, but are not limited to, unresponsiveness or unconsciousness, inability to speak, breathing that is slow, erratic, or has stopped completely, heartbeat that is slow, erratic, or has stopped completely, skin tone that has turned blue or gray, choking or gurgling sounds.
If you think someone is overdosing, call 911 immediately. Start rescue breathing and administer naloxone if you have it. You cannot get in trouble for being on drugs, so always call 911 in an emergency.
For more information about naloxone kits and training, visit towardtheheart.com.
Thank you and stay safe.
You're listening to the Arman and Akhil Show on CITR 101.9 FM. We're talking to historian and author Daniel Francis, whose 2021 book, Becoming Vancouver, was shortlisted for the Basil Stewart Stubbs Prize for Outstanding Scholarly Book on British Columbia and the George Weiger Award, for Social Awareness in Literature. Reading your book, you touch on themes of, you know, exclusion and intolerance in the history of the city. What is the historical context for the current tension in the downtown east side? And, you know, there are really two questions here. One of them has to do with the social segregation aspect of it, and the other as it relates to drug poisoning and violence against women. So what's the history there?
The history of the downtown east side is goes back, I would say, into the 1950s. Well, I mean, the history of the area, it's where the city began. But I'm thinking of its kind of deterioration as a neighborhood, although I don't like to use that word. But anyway, until the 1950s, it was a really vibrant center of the city. Certainly, nobody would have had any fear of going there or fear of violence or anything. It was always an area that had attracted the seasonal workers who would come there in the winters, laid off from their camps up the coast and so on. So it was always an area that had fairly inexpensive hotels, places to live, lots of bars and stuff. But it also had, you know, Hastings Street, which is the Great White Way, theaters, shopping. Woodward's was down there. People would come in from outside the city and go to the theaters and go shopping. And then in the 1950s, it took a number of hits and involved mainly with transportation. The streetcar, the central streetcar station used to be there at Carroll and Hastings. The ferries came from the North Shore. The Union steamships came, brought people in from the coast. Every day, tens of thousands of people would be debarked into the downtown east side to go about their business. And so it kept it very vibrant and active. And then one by one, these things shut down. The Union steamship shut down in the 50s. The ferry to the North Shore shut down. The BC Electric changed its headquarters to the building we were talking about earlier. And, of course, the streetcars disappeared from the streets. And so all of this economic vibrancy all of a sudden was removed from the downtown east side. And there's people who would suggest that that was really the beginning of the economic deterioration of the neighborhood. And I guess combined with that, with some of the social problems we see now, are at about that time, a little later, I guess we're talking about the 80s now, with the closure of mental hospitals, the large mental hospital as a model for the treatment of mental illness everywhere in Canada, everywhere in North America, probably everywhere in the world, this was happening, but it was happening here in BC as well. And it was supposed to be replaced by a certain kind of community care, and people would be looked after in a more humane setting than the large institution. This didn't happen, so that an awful lot of people who need healthcare ended up on the streets of the downtown east side as well. And this also added to the mix of problems that the community faced.
Yeah, so another kind of perennial issue in Vancouver are conflicts over land use. And they do also stretch back to the origins of the city. How has the conversation over land use changed, or has it not changed, you know, over the, you know, the time span, you know, that your book is covering? You know, keeping in mind when we started, there was like, you know, it was conflict with, you know, even just like, you know, displacing huge amounts of, you know, indigenous people.
Yes, it's one of the interesting arcs in the history of the city. The way when the city started, so we're talking 1886, and for decades afterwards, the indigenous inhabitants, of which there were many, were systematically displaced. So that aside from the Musqueam, who still live on the territory they've always lived on, out on the Fraser River. But there was a known as the Kitsilano Reserve. There was a community's Senac down on Kitsilano Point. There were communities in Stanley Park. There were several indigenous settlements around what became Vancouver. And one by one, they were all eradicated, and the land was taken over by white settlement. And the people were displaced and usually sent and had to move to one of the outlying reserves on the North Shore or somewhere else. And then today, for several decades now, obviously, that process has been reversed. And certain settlements were made, for instance, to the Squamish people for their displacement from Senac. Agreements were made earlier in this century with the federal government. But now we see actually that that companies controlled, partly owned by the three indigenous groups, the Squamish, the Tsleil-Waututh, and the Musqueam, now control some of the most valuable land in the city and are partnering with developers. And much of the development that will happen in Vancouver over the next 20 years is on land that has been given back to the indigenous people, or they've purchased back, and they are the developers themselves. So it's one of the biggest changes, I think, one would describe in the history of the city since its founding in 1886.
Yeah, and then also in terms of one thing that struck me was initially, you know, when there were, you're talking about, you know, labor action and stuff, there's, you know, huge volumes of people coming into the city. The even though they were, you know, falling on hard times, the housing question does seem to me to be more pressing now than it was in the past. Or is that just my millennial kind of myopia?
There were periods where there was a pressing issue. At the end of the Second World War, I talk about in the book a bit, with so many veterans returning from overseas, getting married. But there was land then to expand onto. So it wasn't hard to sort of solve, if you can use that word, the crisis, because you just, there was so much land in the south as you expanded south towards the river. So they just built more subdivisions. Now, I think you're quite right. It's more acute because there's less land. We've slowly used up most of the industrial land that used to be within the city limits, and we've kind of run out of space. And so the question is more acute, I think. Plus, this absurd escalation in cost. I don't think there's been an earlier period where it was as difficult for young families or young people generally to get into a housing market. I don't think it's ever been as difficult as it is in as it is now. So I think you're right.
That's relieving.
The issue is more acute.
Yeah, and because as you mentioned, right, there were seasonal workers that formed that really did drive the economy of the city during many periods in its history, where they would come back from the logging camps or mining camps, and they would come back to the city. And you know, there's stories of Gassy Jack giving of cutting them off, just giving them enough alcohol they could stay the winter, but then cutting them off when they needed to go back to the camps to make more money.
Uh-huh.
You know, definitely that's been a conversation that's happened throughout. And different forms. Now it's affordability, but back in the book you write at the beginning where there were fights between landowners and the CPR in the early history of the city. So what was the influence of the CPR in the early history of the city and as land use goes?
Well, yes, the CPR is the most influential factor in the history of the city. Not so much now.
Can I just tell our listeners what CPR stands for?
Oh, the Canadian Pacific Railway.
Yeah, I should have
done
that.
Thank you. So this Vancouver really began in 1886 because the Canadian Pacific Railway, which had built its way across the country and was now looking for a terminus on the Pacific Ocean, settled on this location for its terminus. And in return for that, they were given most of what is now Vancouver, free. So it was a huge land grant. This was typical of the way the CPR operated in other places as well, but nowhere were they treated as kindly by the provincial government as they were in British Columbia. So they were given most of the downtown peninsula and most of the land south of False Creek as far as the river. Not all of it, but most of it. And then they got it for free. They would say they got it in return for building a railway. And then they slowly sold it back to the city over time, or sold it, subdivided it, and subdivided it and sold it to individual homeowners. But in order to sort of control the market, the land that they had, and keep prices up and so on, they had a great influence over public policy. So the CPR was instrumental, for instance, in the creation of Stanley Park, which was one of the first items on the agenda of a new city council in 1886, was to ask the federal government to give what's now Stanley Park, which was then a military reserve, to give it to the city to be used as a park. And this was the CPR's idea. Because originally they had wanted to take over that land, but when it was refused to them, they didn't want anybody else in the future, maybe getting a hold of it and subdividing it and selling property. So they made sure that it was created as a public park in perpetuity. They had a great influence on where our city hall is located. Vancouver is sort of unique. I don't know. I don't want to say unique, but unusual in not having a city hall downtown in terms compared to major cities in North America. We have it slightly to the south, as everybody knows. And the CPR wanted this location because it was close to where their property was owned, and they thought it would keep the values of their real estate up as Vancouver spread in that direction to the south. They were instrumental in trying to foil the building of the causeway through Stanley Park and the building of the Lionsgate Bridge, which was built by a consortium of engineers and international finance to make it possible for people to reach the British properties, where famously the Guinness brewing people own property, still do. And they wanted to subdivide it. You needed access to it, build a bridge. So the CPR did all it could behind the scenes politically to keep the province and the federal government from okaying the construction of the causeway through the park and giving people access to that real estate. There's hardly an issue in in Vancouver history that somehow doesn't involve the CPR. And it comes down to, people will remember, just a few years ago and the building and the opening of the Arbutus Greenway, which was land that the CPR still owned and still wanted money for. I forget how many millions of dollars the city had to pay. They were not running a railway anymore, but they sat on that land that they had been given for nothing originally, and then they sold it for several million dollars back to the city. So time and again, historically, the CPR has been at the center of big issues in the city's history.
Yeah, and I think a lot of Vancouverites would be quite surprised, if not shocked, that just the outright influence that the CPR has had in almost every part of the city's evolution. Because today we don't really think about the CPR in the city at all. Unless you're driving by Pacific Central or you see one of their trains in the rail yard, you don't really think about that company as being intertwined with the city of Vancouver.
That's right. And you mentioned the rail yards and stuff. I guess that's why False Creek began as the industrial center. It's hard to think of it now as the industrial center because it's changed so much. But until the 1960s, it was the industrial heart of the city. It was filled with sawmills and lumber yards and this, that, and the other thing. It was a sewer. It began because that's where the CPR put its rail yards, where the roundhouse is now. Put its rail yards in 1886 when the city began.
Yeah, I wanted to circle back on something you mentioned earlier. So you mentioned, you know, Kit Solano, and in the book, it actually starts with this important actor in the narrative of Vancouver, August Jack Kit Solano. Could you tell our listeners a bit more about him and how that relates to how he relates to the region we know now as Kitsilano?
Yes, I get what to, I'm not sure of the relation. The Kitsilano is not named for August Jack, but it's named for, I think, maybe an uncle or a grandfather. I'm sorry that I don't know the precise lineage, but there was a chief Kitsilano who was Squamish, who came from Howe Sound and settled, started a village called Senac on Kitsilano Point. And August Jack, who was actually, I think, from the reserve on the North Shore and was a longshoreman, but he was also a man who was very interested in the history of his own people and the history of Burrard Inlet and his people in Burrard Inlet. And he fortuitously came together with another key figure in the history of the city, Major Matthews, our first archivist who created the archives, and was a great collector of stories, early memorabilia, but stories, most importantly, about the early history of the city. Those two met and would meet regularly, and August Jack would tell his stories and what he knew. And Matthews would copy them down and so on. And out of that comes a lot of the what we know about the history of the early city. And so I thought it was a nice place to begin the story with an indigenous person and the role of the indigenous people in the history and preserving the history of the city.
And because they are, they do form the lion's share of the history of the city before its modern iteration anyway.
Yeah, that's right. I begin with the early explorers because I don't feel qualified to go back further. But obviously this is just the latest bit of Vancouver history. The site goes back a long way.
Long time. Well, speaking about the city of Vancouver, and we spoke about Lewis Taylor a little earlier. Lewis Taylor was a former mayor of Vancouver for 11 years on and off and on. He's a recurring character in Becoming Vancouver. You also wrote a book about him. Could you tell us, our listeners, a little bit about him, about Lewis Taylor and why you find him so fascinating?
Yeah. I mentioned earlier that one of the things I found fascinating about him is that he had sort of been erased from the history, and I wondered why. Other things that I find fascinating about him was what he did say about his life was almost all fabricated, or at least fabricated in important ways. So that when I started the project, for instance, I found this great 10-part series of an interview with him from the 1930s. From the Vancouver Province newspaper. And he was talking about his life. He was now in his 80s, retired, talking to a journalist about his life thing. And most of the most important things he told the guy were not true, as I discovered when I started looking into his... I won't get involved in the whole story about how I discovered...
Can you give an example? That's fascinating.
Yes, I will. But I discovered this cache of family papers down in California through his great-grandson, and discovered all this correspondence from Taylor to his family when he first came to Vancouver, and so was able to discover certain things about him. So he always said that he didn't come to Vancouver till he was in his 40s from Chicago. And he always said he came because he was going to the gold rush in the Yukon. So he came in 1898. Well, he may have been going to the gold rush, but he fled Chicago one step ahead of the law because the bank that he'd been involved in had gone broke and he'd been charged with embezzlement. So like many people who came to Vancouver at that time, he came here to reinvent himself. He also was a bigamist, I discovered. He married his second wife while he was still married to his first wife. So there were things like that he wasn't completely straightforward about because he was a politician. And it wouldn't have been good politics to let the public know that he had been, he had been wanted for crimes and a failed banker and
that's so
jailbird from from Chicago.
It's interesting how politics have changed now. Like, I think, as we know, it's totally possible for people like that to run and get elected. But now it's a bit harder for that information just not to.
Yes, of course. Everybody knows everything now. But then it wasn't hard to escape your past. I mean, who would know, right? So, he even went back to the state shortly after he came here. So I suppose the authorities didn't even know at that time.
I had some amnesia about crimes committed by a man a few years before.
Yeah.
That's fascinating. And that isn't actually covered in your book. But in your book, you also, you know, he's this newspaper man who writes these very kind of polemic articles, I understand, that they accuse him of stirring up, you know, people in rioting and stuff.
Yeah, he was considered a radical, which was one of the other things that appealed to me about him, the fact that the city would have this radical past. So he was considered, he called himself a socialist. He wasn't a socialist. He was a small business-minded entrepreneur, really. But he did have a sympathy for working people, and that was where his backing lay in the city. This division we have now, right down to the present east side, west side, on the city, politically speaking, and well, in many ways, but politically speaking, existed then, and he got his support on the east side. As I say, was considered a bit of a radical. So the establishment didn't like him. And one of the papers in particular, which was owned by a prominent Tory and was a conservative paper then, The Province, went out of its way, of course, to oppose him on almost everything. So it was very lively time in journalism as well as politics at the time.
A journalist can go and become a mayor.
So, yeah, but that wasn't unusual at that time. I mean, newspapers were so prominent in the community, and they were biased. They made no bones about being objective. So, a newspaper was a spokesman usually for a political party at the time. And so he used his newspaper to promote his political career as much as he could.
That's very interesting because we have this general idea that news is more polarized and more lopsided today in some ways, and
yeah.
I think some people have this interesting idea that news was more balanced.
Yeah.
In a previous era. That's really interesting that you had a newspaperman who was a bigamist, a radical, someone who accused of embezzlement who came here, started a newspaper, and then ran for mayor.
So what was
and then did a lot of good things.
What were his achievements? Yeah, what did he do?
The Burrard Street Bridge was built during his time. He was very active in the single tax movement, which was a big reform movement early in the century. What were some of the other things he accomplished? He was certainly very, as I say, very involved as a spokesman for the east side of the city. He pioneered the 8-hour day for employees of the city. I must say, he was also an active member of the Asiatic Exclusion League, which started riots against, campaigned against Asian immigration. So he was very much on the wrong side, in our terms, on that issue, but very caught up in that debate at the time.
Well, he failed in that regard.
Yeah. I'm sorry?
He failed in keeping out the Asiatic people.
That's right.
Clearly.
Yeah.
Cool. This is slightly tangential, but it's a slightly cheesy question as well. But, if you were to drop like a Gen Z or millennial back 100 years, what do you think is the thing that would, stand out to them or they would find the most, absurd? About how the city was, or unexpected, surprising, and then the second part to that question, if that isn't cheesy enough, is if you were to take somebody from that time, and put them in our era, what would they be most surprised about?
Specifically about the city of Vancouver.
Yeah.
Well, 100 years is 1923, eh?
Yeah.
So certainly one of the most obvious things about Vancouver was how small it was. Vancouver, we forget now, was actually quite a small area centered on the downtown peninsula in the main, False Creek. The border of Vancouver was 16th Avenue until 1929. So it was a pretty small town. And I would guess... that and the streetcar It was a rail city in a way that it isn't anymore. A railway city, I mean. So that it had, what, 3-4 transcontinental railways we were the terminus of by the time the First World War came along. And the street railway, instead of wheeled buses, ran everywhere in the city. So you'd be very struck by the presence, the sounds, the smells, and so on, of railways and of industry. The as I mentioned before, False Creek was an industrial center, but so was Coal Harbor. Until the Bayshore Hotel was built in 1960, that marked the gentrification of Coal Harbor. But until then, it was an industrial area. There was a huge sawmill there right at the entrance to Stanley Park, filled with shipyards, machine works, engine people who made engines for small boats, and so on. So it was really a dirty place, a very foggy, smoggy place, which I suppose your person from 100 years would notice right away. The air was terrible here. I can remember even in my childhood, the fogs in the 1950s, you couldn't see anything. My father once told me that he was a doctor, and the fogs would be so bad that when he was called out to see a patient, he would get the car positioned over the railway, the streetcar tracks, and open his driver's door so he could look down and make sure that he was staying on top of the streetcar tracks to get him where he was going, because he couldn't see anything ahead of him. So these are some of the things I think you'd notice. What would somebody from 1923 make of Vancouver? Well, I guess they'd just be gobsmacked at the size, not the area, but the size of buildings and so on. They would have trouble believing.
And it's I wonder. Yeah.
What do you think?
I don't know. I think the technology, I guess because I work in technology space, I feel the technology aspect as well.
Sure.
Would probably both ways blow people's mind in terms of what technology people were using at the time. And especially, I imagine in the 1920s, they had at the time what they thought was quite sophisticated technology, right?
Sure, of course.
They thought they were high tech.
Yeah.
And they had all this very big equipment that had a lot of spinning parts and stuff, right?
And I think the person would be really surprised by just how much tourism we have in Vancouver today.
Because oh, yeah.
Those conditions weren't really, I mean, you don't really, you know, imagine taking a vacation to a place that's heavily polluted, that's heavily industrial. But that's something that is...
And the multicultural aspect. Of
multicultural that. Aspect. Yes. But just how much tourism is in the city today, I think is something that would completely shock them.
Yeah, it would. But the multicultural aspect is something I should have mentioned too, obviously, that the person would from today would notice how non-diverse Vancouver was in 1923. It had its Chinatown, and it's had what was then called Japantown, the Powell Street area. But Asian residents made up maybe 6%, I think it was, 7% of the population. So that's an obvious difference.
All right. So that brings us to the end of today's show. The music you heard is called Song of the Mies. It was specially composed for us by a close friend of the show, the remarkably gifted Sarah Pratt.
Just unbelievably gifted.
Incredibly. You can listen to more of her on SoundCloud at the handle Leisure Noise if you haven't checked it out already.
Yeah, a few other things to wrap up. You can now find us at the Armonicle, not Amarn Armonicle, on Instagram and Twitter. So check us out there.
We do have some awesome set of guests lined up for you. Do continue to listen and subscribe. You can find all of our episodes on our podcast feed, including our recent interview with City Councilor Christine Boyle. Do check it out. Finally, we'd like to give a huge thanks to Daniel Francis for joining the show tonight. Thank you so much. Any closing remarks?
No, just thank you very much for inviting me.
All right. Take care and have a good night.